The Virginia Voice presents storyteller Les Schaefer, telling stories of Hanukkah.
Now, as we near the winter solstice, people all over the world find it good to light candles. For nearly 3,000 years, the Jewish people have been celebrating Hanukkah, the festival of lights. By lighting the candles of Hanukkah, telling the story of the Maccabees, we are fully prepared to believe in miracles, to demonstrate the willingness to assure ourselves that with faith, anything is possible. My name is Les Schaefer, and I invite you to settle back, light a candle, on the mantle or in your mind, and listen with all your ears to some stories of Hanukkah. At sunset, Friday evening, December 11, 2009, Jewish families all over the world will gather for the festive meal that marks the beginning of Hanukkah. However, before sitting down to eat, the menorah, the 8-branch candle holder used during this holiday, is set in a place of honor. The shamus, the candle used to light the others, is lit and used on this night to light the first candle. As the wick is lit, the blessings are recited. Blessed is the Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who hallows us with his mitzvot, commands us to kindle the Hanukkah lights. And a second blessing adds, Blessed is the Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who performed wondrous deeds for our ancestors in days of old at this season. When we think of Hanukkah, we may immediately think of a day's worth of oil burning for 8 days. This may only be a legend. The story of the oil does not appear in the books of the Maccabees, although oil is mentioned in the Talmud several hundred years later. But even legends have an origin. Hanukkah is a festival which commemorates the successful Jewish revolt led by the Maccabees in 165 BC. Under the rule of the Seleucids, Hellenic Syrians, Jews were required to adhere to Hellenic life and customs and had thus lost the right to observe their own religion. After years of fighting the elephants, the war machines, the entire armed might of the Seleucids, finally, on the 25th day of the month of Kislev, the Maccabees, led by Judah, the son of Matthias, and his brothers, defeated the ruler Antiochus and reclaimed the temple in Jerusalem, which had been defiled and desecrated. After cleansing and purifying the temple, the Maccabees rededicated it. The word Hanukkah means dedication, and they rekindled the lights of the menorah, the branched lampstand. According to legend, the only remaining purified oil was sufficient to last for a day, but miraculously it burned for 8 days. By lighting the lights of the menorah for 8 days, the Jewish people remember the miracle of the oil and the triumph of a small band of people who fought for and won the freedom to act according to their beliefs. The horse that wouldn't eat latkes, from the storyteller. Copyright by Mirkos Lianyoye Shinuch. One wintry Hanukkah night, a weary traveler stopped by an inn at the roadside. He was cold and hungry, and he was thinking of a warm fireplace and steaming latkes, potato pancakes. From this you can gather that the traveler was a Jew, and the innkeeper was likewise a Jew. When the traveler came in, the fireside was fully occupied by lazy-looking people chatting idly. They took no notice of the newcomer, and nobody offered him a place by the fireside. The traveler took out a little prayer book, recited the evening prayers. Then he brought out a Hanukkah lamp and a bottle of pure olive oil. He filled the lamp with oil, prepared fresh wicks, and lit the Hanukkah lamp, reciting the blessings in a clear and joyous voice. But still, nobody in the room took any notice of him. Presently, the innkeeper's servant came in and asked him if he wished to order anything to eat. "But first, before I eat, my horse must be taken care of." Then, to the servant's amazement, the traveler ordered a bowl of latkes for the horse. The servant stood there, not knowing what to make of it. And the traveler repeated the order in a louder voice and added, "And be sure that the latkes are steaming hot and well fried, and have a bowl of heavy sour cream with it. But make haste, my friend, make haste. My horse is hungry." The people sitting around the fireplace now raised their heads and were suddenly quite interested. They'd never heard of a horse that eats steaming hot latkes, with sour cream at that. And one by one, they got up and went into the stable to watch this strange sight. No sooner were they gone than the traveler made himself comfortable at the fireplace. He smiled happily, but when he heard footsteps, he pretended to be serious. The embarrassed servant came in with the steaming hot latkes and sour cream, followed by the crowd of curious people. "Sir, these men are my witnesses. The horse did not even touch the latkes. He would just have none of them, with or without the sour cream. It's the honest truth, sir."
"Is that so? Well, never mind. The poor horse must have forgotten his Hanukkah. And if he knows no better, then he deserves nothing better than oats. Give him his oats, then. And by the way, friend, I'll have the latkes. I'm hungry, too. Place them right here by the fireside."
And turning to the others, he said jovially, "Good Hanukkah, gentlemen. Does anyone care to join me?" The Pseudo Hanukkah Fairy, a story by Ted Roberts. Now, one thing I know is how to communicate with granddaughters. "How about a nice soup bowl full of fudge ripple ice cream and a Hanukkah story?" I asked my 8-year-old Sarah. While I'm planning my pitch and dipping out the ice cream, she says, "Is it a love story, like Purim?"
No.
Is there a little girl in the story?"
"Not exactly."
"Well, I like stories about little girls."
"Well, okay. How about a story of a little girl and what happened to her on Hanukkah, which in fact happens to be her birthday?"
The object of my strategy sits straight up in her chair, even puts down her spoon, and establishes direct eye contact. She's ready to listen. I know the signs. So I begin. "Once there was a newly married couple, not rich but happy. Sam was a computer repairman. Esther was a nursing technician. One day, Sam notices that Esther is smiling more than usual, and she's glowing with a healthy, happy look."
"Yes," says Esther. "We, but mainly me, are going to have a baby."
So, on a brisk day in March, Sam and Esther went to the doctor to check her out, make sure everything's okay, and it was. The doctor's final statement was, "This baby could be born on the first candle of Hanukkah." And it was. Esther's birth pangs started as she touched her match to the first candle. And it was a girl.
"Just like me," my listener says.
"Yes, and they named her Sarah.
Also just like me.
Now, you got to know, this is not an accident. We foxy storytellers have bags full of such tricks."
And on her naming day, friends and relatives, as well as a table full of delicatessen, crowded the small living room of Sam and Esther. Among the crowd was a pretty young lady with golden locks and a blue pantsuit.
"Well, who are you?" asked the new parents.
"I'm the fairy godmother," said the golden girl, as she ate a thick corned beef sandwich and sipped a diet Pepsi.
"I never heard of a Jewish fairy godmother," said Sam.
"Me neither," says my entranced listener.
"Well," says Mrs. Blue Pantsuit, "you probably never heard of a lot of things. What do you want? Want me to use a wand to spread mustard on the pastrami sandwich I'm going to eat next? Here, watch this." And she pulled a shiny silver dollar out of Sarah's right ear.
"And I'll tell you what," said the fairy godmother, this fairy godmother without a wand or a halo,
"I'll come every year on the first night of Hanukkah and bring your child a Hanukkah gelt, a silver dollar."
And Sam interrupted her.
"Silver dollar, big deal. By the time she's bat mitzvahed, it won't buy her a fountain pen."
"Yeah," continued the fairy godmother, "but when she's 21, I'll bring 21 of those $100 U.S. gold pieces, every one a collector's item. But only, if when she's old enough, she faithfully lights candles every night of Hanukkah and models her life after Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel."
Well, that was the deal. And sure enough, every year she came with her Hanukkah gelt. They became friends. And finally, 21 years later, it's the first night of Hanukkah, and little Sarah has turned into a beautiful young lady with black eyes and curly soft brown hair.
"I will too," says my granddaughter.
"Right. And here comes the fairy godmother, but without a bag of gold pieces. And what a story she tells Sarah. Listen," she says, "I'm not really a fairy godmother, but I felt like having a nice corned beef sandwich that night you were named. And I'm pretty good at magic tricks. Want me to do the silver dollar trick again?"
It was a total confession.
Sarah gulped.
"What a disappointment. No gold pieces."
But you know what she did? As soon as her non-fairy godmother left, she got out a pad of yellow paper and wrote down the story of the fake fairy godmother. The same story I'm telling you. And after a few months of calling up Hollywood big shots, she sold the story for $1 million. A couple of minutes of silent spooning up of soupy ice cream followed.
"I'll never forget to light my Hanukkah candles," my Sarah said.
And maybe when I grow up, I'll use this story and write a movie play. After all, the little girl looked like me, you said.
"Maybe so," I say. "But when you get that six-figure advance, don't you forget your poor old grandfather."
This next story, The Trees of the Dancing Goats, is probably my favorite Hanukkah story, and it's adopted from a story by Patricia Polacco. At our farm in upstate New York, we didn't just celebrate the same holidays as most of our neighbors, but we shared their delight and anticipation just the same.
"Ay, such cold the winter brings, my babushka," my grandmother said, as she looked out of our front window. "My bones, it makes so to ache," and she slapped her chest.
Then she caught my eye and winked. She wasn't fooling me. I knew how much she loved the snow. It reminded her of her old homeland in the Ukraine.
"Dora, again you complain, but still you watch the snow with such a light in your eyes," Grandpa said, and he threw her a kiss. My grandpa was from Bielorussia, way to the south of the Ukraine. He and Babushka spoke Russian and had wonderful accents.
They kept their homelands in their hearts, even though they would never be permitted to return. Just then, Mama rolled into the long driveway. "Mama's home! Mama's home!" my sister Phyllis called as we watched her get out of the car. Mama drove way over to town every day to teach school, but now she would be off for 2 weeks because of the holiday season. I loved having her home for winter vacation. This year, we would have a week together to prepare, and then 8 days of Hanukkah festivities. The next day, Mama took out our old menorah and asked me to polish it. While I rubbed it, I watched my grandma make the candles that we would put in it. Babushka tied long strips to a metal rod and dipped them into a pot of melted beeswax that she kept on the stove. Then she hung the wax-covered strings on the wall to dry before dipping them again to add another layer of wax. She hummed as she dipped, and she never seemed to tire of this long process. Grandpa prepared for our festival of lights as well. He carved small toys out of wood. Phyllis and I weren't supposed to know that he was making them for us, but he did every year. And that afternoon, when he went into town, we couldn't help sneaking into his workroom to take a peek. "Look, a dancing goat," my sister exclaimed as she held one up. "I like this one," I said, cradling a little dog in my palm. Grandpa had painted the animals with the colors of his homeland. We marvel at how magical they all were. "Do you think he made enough for all 8 days of Hanukkah?" Richard asked. She looked at that array of wooden figures and wondered. "You know he has." I took one last look, knowing that soon Grandpa would wrap them up in colored paper. Then my mama called for me. I thought she caught us spying. But no, she only wanted me to go over to the Kremels for some cornmeal. The Kremels were our nearest neighbors and lived half a mile down the road. They were farmers like us, and at harvest time, Mr. Kremel always helped Grandpa. All our neighbors helped each other this way. "Friendship means something," Grandpa would always say, "especially for those who till the soil." I practically lived at the Kremels, because Stephen Kremel was my very best friend. We especially loved this holiday season. I'd watch his family decorate their Christmas tree, and he'd watch my family light our menorah. And I knew as we were bustling in anticipation of the festival of lights at our house, the Kremels would be preparing for the festival of Christmas at theirs. But no. When I got to his house, I found everybody was really sick. Even Stephen, who is usually full of spitzerinko, as my babushka would say, seemed quiet and weak. He was near tears. "Oh, I hope Santa will remember where we live," he wailed. "Well, why wouldn't he?" I asked. "Because we haven't put up a tree this year, even decorated. Pa's too sick to get out of bed and chop one down." And then he coughed an awful cough. I ran home and burst into our house with the news about Stephen and his family. Mama seemed very worried. "Did you go inside their house, Leslie?"
Sure.
"Oh," my sister said.
"When your grandpa was in town today," Babushka said very slowly, "the doctor told him that many families around here have come down with the scarlet fever."
"The Kremels must have it, and I sent you there," my ma said, and she rushed me into the bathroom, pulled off my clothes, and scrubbed every inch of me. "Am I going to get it, Mama?"
"It's very contagious. We'll know in a few days, dear."
Am I gonna die?"
"No, baby," Mama said softly, and she held me close. "But if you have it, it will make you very sick."
For the next few days, my family watched me carefully. Phyllis, of course, took pleasure in making me feel like I was quarantined. She held a cloth over her mouth and nose every time she came near me. Then she'd hack and gag, mimicking that dreadful cough of the fever. But as the days passed, it was evident that I wasn't going to get sick. But more and more reports came to us of our neighbors falling ill. The Everests and the Govlucks and the Tundervalts, the Molleskis. It was an epidemic. We were all worried about our friends. But Babushka was determined that our festival of lights would go on as planned.
On the afternoon before Hanukkah, she bustled around the kitchen. "Oy, such latkes I'll make this year," she exclaimed while digging for the best potatoes in the bin. She hummed happily as she placed the potatoes in front of me, and I peeled and I shredded them with great care. They had to be just right for my babushka's latkes. Mama and babushka dressed down 2 chickens for roasting and put them in the oven. And just as the aroma of that wonderful feast met our nostrils, the sun set, and it was time to light the menorah. Grandpa recited the blessings and lit the shamus, the candle we used to light all the others. Babushka put the first candle on the menorah and lit it with the shamus. Then Mama told the story, like she did every year, of our people long ago. Tonight, we are celebrating miracles. The miracle that a very small band of Jewish farmers turned soldiers could defeat a huge Syrian army. "Were they really farmers before they were soldiers?" my sister asked. "Simple farmers," Grandpa said, "just like us." "They were fighting so that they could worship in their own way," my mom added. "And then there was the miracle of the light," my grandpa said with a twinkle in his eye. "One little tin of oil burned in the temple for 8 days." "Such a miracle," my babushka exclaimed. "Miracles can happen even today," Grandpa said very quietly. After dinner, Grandpa handed us the first of our beautifully wrapped presents. He looked troubled, though. "You know, our neighbors are having such a hard time. This should be a time of gladness for them. If we could only do something to make their holiday special." Babushka thought for a while. "They always bring a tree into their house. Only in America does a tree grow right out of the living room floor." And she rocked with laughter. "Dora, we should cut down trees and take them to their houses," Grandpa announced. And Babushka smiled in agreement. "I'll cut them tonight. You can help, Leslie," my grandpa said. He was already pulling on his winter coat. "We can dress down more chickens and take them food," Grandma said as she scurried into the kitchen. "And Mama and Phyllis can decorate the trees," I shouted. "But this is not our custom. We have nothing to decorate trees with," my grandma said. "What about the carvings?" my mama said softly. The grown-ups looked at my sister and I. "What do you think? They have no way of making their children happy this year." At first, I was a little disappointed. But then, as I thought about it, I knew it was the right thing to do. Our neighbors needed cheering, and we were just about the only ones who didn't have the fever. Grandpa and I brought the cut trees into our living room. We nailed boards onto the bottom of each one so they would stand up. They were very small trees. We'd only taken the tops off the evergreens. But they were beautiful, and when they were all standing in the living room, it looked like a forest. "Aye, like the woods just outside my village when I was a little girl," Babushka said. Grandpa started hanging some of his wooden animals on the branches of a tree. "A dancing goat," my grandma remarked as she looked closely at one of them. "We shall call these the trees of the dancing goats." And we made sure to put a dancing goat on each and every tree. And as we decorated the trees, we sang and we laughed. The single candle in our menorah flickered as we rushed past it to reach another carved animal or to paste together paper chains to hang on the trees. We worked way into the night. And when Grandpa and Phyllis and I finished the decorating, Babushka and Mama roasted more chickens and fried more potato latkes, and then they packed the food into baskets. And in each one, Babushka put one of her homemade Hanukkah candles, so they will have the light of God in their hearts, and so that God will protect them and make them well again. We loaded Grandpa's old Ford truck with the trees and the food baskets and sent Babushka and Grandpa off into the early light of dawn with their Christmas cheer. "Just like Santa," my sister said. "Mr. and Mrs. Santa," I added.
We waited eagerly for their return later that morning, and we were thrilled when Babushka and Grandpa told us how they entered the home of each neighbor, set up a tree in the living room, put the basket of food on the table, then put a candle in a holder for them to light later on. Mama was a little worried that they'd been exposed to the fever, but Babushka said, "In so much worse we've been, you shouldn't know from it. God will protect. God will protect. This I know." Well, a week later, the 8 days of Hanukkah had come and gone, and we sat down to have our last feast. There was a knock at the door. "Now, who could that be?" Babushka asked, and she scurried to the door with her usual warm smile. "It was the Kremels, Stephen and his mom and dad. We have something for you," Stephen said, and the family came into the house. They looked so pale, but they assured us they were quite well. Stephen was holding a big basket. His mom and dad had tears in their eyes as they hugged my grandparents and mother. "Look at what my dad made for you," Stephen said, and he pulled out a menorah that Mr. Kreml had carved out of wood. And on it he had mounted some of the animals we had given to them. "Ay, how beautiful," my Babushka said. She placed it on the table. "Come sit," Grandpa invited us. "You're so welcome. Thank you, thank you." "Thank you, George," Mr. Kreml said, looking straight into Grandpa's eyes. They sat down and shared our feast. By this time, our menorah had been lit for an hour or so, and when we lit the candles in the new menorah, we noticed something. Something wondrous. "Look, look," I called out. "Our old candles aren't exactly as tall as the new ones." "The old ones don't even look burned down," Mama said softly. "Another miracle," Grandpa said. "A miracle indeed," my Babushka said, and gave me a big hug. Then we all got up and danced and laughed in the flickering candlelight. All of our neighbors recovered from that terrible fever. Few were left with any permanent damage. What they were left with was a long cherished memory of that Christmas when Santa really did come. And my family, too, has never forgotten that incredible winter of the fever, the miracle of true friendship, and the trees of the dancing goats.
You've been listening to storyteller Les Schaefer, telling stories of Hanukkah, presented by the Virginia Voice.
Lick for Hanukkah. is the Virginia Voice, broadcasting in Central Virginia over the subcarrier of WCVE-FM, and in the Hampton Roads area over the subcarrier of the WHRO Voice at WHRO-FM in Norfolk. Virginia Voice, connect by listening.
The Virginia Voice presents storyteller Les Schaefer, telling stories of the Hanukkah season.
A poem by Simcoe Ward. Through the window. Through the crisp yellow night, I saw lights. Lights in the window, 8 bright lights. I wondered why I couldn't light tonight. I told myself I would light. I would light tonight. 8 lights I would light tonight. I knocked on the door with the lights. They answered the door and asked, what would I like? I answered them, to light tonight, 8 lights I would like to light tonight. As they led me into the house as bright as the sun, I told them they would have to help, for I had not lit since I was young. As soon as I lit, I fell in love. I fell in love with Hanukkah. Through the Window by Simcoe Ward. The Hasidic branch of the Jewish faith is full of wonderful stories. Here's one, The Vanished Flame. Despite the Hasid's shocking physical state, his eyes sparkled with joy. It was the first night of Hanukkah. Outside, a snowstorm raged, but inside it was tranquil and warm. The Rebbe, Rabbi Baruch of Mezibuz, grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidims, stood in front of the menorah, surrounded by a crowd of his Hasids. He recited the blessings with great devotion, lit a single candle, placed the shamash, the servant candle, in its designated place, and began to sing the blessings. His face radiated holiness and joy. The awed Hasidim stared intently at him. The flame of the candle was burning strongly. The Rebbe and the Hasidim sat nearby and sang the Hanukkah songs. All of a sudden, the candle began to flicker and leap wildly, even though there wasn't the slightest breeze in the room. It was as if it were dancing. Was struggling. And then it disappeared. It didn't blow out. There was no smoke. It was just not there anymore. It was as if it blew off, flew off somewhere else. The Rebbe himself seemed lost in thought. His attendant went over to relight the wick, but the Rebbe waved him off. He motioned to the Hasidim to continue singing. Several times between tunes, the Rebbe spoke words of Torah. The evening passed delightfully, and the Hasid's present had all but forgotten the disappearing Hanukkah candle. It was nearly midnight when the harsh sound of carriage wheels grating on the snow and ice exploded the tranquility. The door burst open, and in came a Hasid who hailed from a distant village. His appearance was shocking. His clothes were ripped and filthy. His face was puffy and bleeding. And yet, in stark contrast to his physical state, his eyes were sparkling and his features shone with joy. He sat down at the table and, with all eyes upon him, began to speak excitedly. "This isn't the first time I come here by the forest route. I know the way very well, but there was a terrible snowstorm this week which greatly slowed me. I began to worry that I wouldn't get here in time to be with the Rebbe for the first night of Hanukkah. Ay, the thought disturbed me so much I decided not to wait out the storm, but to plod ahead and travel day and night and hope that I could reach my destination in time. That was a foolish idea, I must admit, but I didn't realize that until too late. Last night, I ran into a gang of bandits. They were quite pleased to encounter me. They figured if I was out in this weather at night alone, I must be a wealthy merchant whose business could not brook delay. They demanded that I surrender to them all my money. I tried to explain. I pleaded with them, but they absolutely refused to believe I had no money. They seized the reins of my horse and leapt on my wagon. They sat themselves on either side of me to keep me close, and then drove me and my wagon off to meet their chief to decide my fate. While they waited for their chief to arrive, they questioned me and cross-examined me in great detail. They searched me and my wagon, even the horse. They beat me, trying to elicit the secret of where I had hidden my money. I had nothing to tell them except the truth. That they weren't prepared to accept. After hours of this torture, they bound me and threw me, injured and exhausted, into a dark cellar. I was bleeding from my wounds, and my whole body ached in pain. I lay there until the evening, when the gang leader came to speak to me. I tried again, to the best of my ability, to describe to him the great joy of being in the Rebbe's presence. How it was so important for me to get to the Rebbe by the start of the holiday. It was worth it to endanger myself by traveling at night. It seems that my words must have made an impression in him, or else he was persuaded by my adamancy, even under torture. But whatever it was, thanks God, he released me from the handcuffs and told me, I sense your faith in God is as strong as your longing to be with your Rebbe is genuine and intense. Now we shall see if this is the truth. I'm going to let you go. But you should know that the way is extremely dangerous. Even the most rugged people never venture into the heart of the forest alone, only in groups, and especially not in a storm or at night. You can leave and try your luck. But I'm telling you, if you get through the forest and the other terrible conditions safely, unharmed by the ferocious wild beasts or anything else, I tell you, you do that, I will break up my gang and reform my ways. And if you actually reach the outskirts of the town, then throw your handkerchief into the ditch next to the road behind the signpost there. One of my men will be waiting, and this is how I will know you made it. I then became terrified all over again. The hardships I'd already endured were seared into my soul, and now even more frightening nightmares awaited me. But when I thought about how wonderful it is to be with the Rebbe at the menorah lighting, I shook off all my apprehensions and resolved not to delay another moment. My horse and my carriage were returned to me, and I set off on my way. There was total darkness all around. I could hear the cries of the forest animals, and they sounded close. I feared that I was surrounded by a pack of vicious wolves. I crouched down over my horse's back and spurred him on. He refused to move. It was pitch blackness. He refused to move. I lashed him, and he still didn't budge. I didn't know what to do. I had no idea. At that moment, a small light flickered in front of the carriage. My horse stepped eagerly toward it. The light advanced. The horse followed. All along the way, the wild animals fled from us as if the tiny dancing flame was driving them away. We followed that flame all the way here. I kept my end of the bargain and threw my handkerchief at the designated place. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe those cruel bandits will change their ways, all in the merit of that little light. It was only then that the Hasidim noticed that the Rebbe's Hanukkah light had returned. There it was, burning in the elaborate menorah, its flame strong and pure, as if it had just been lit. Rabbi Israel Spira, called the Grand Rabbi of Blutzov, often called the Blue Rabbi, was a survivor of the Holocaust, and there are many tales. Rabbi Israel Spira, the Grand Rabbi of Blutzov, was a Holocaust survivor. In fact, after World War II, he came here to the United States and lived in Brooklyn for many years. This is one of his stories from Bergen-Belsen, the first Hanukkah light in Bergen-Belsen. In the concentration camp called Bergen-Belsen on the eve of Hanukkah, a selection took place. Early in the morning, three German officers, meticulously dressed in their black uniforms and in visibly high spirits, entered the men's barracks. They ordered the men to stand at the foot of their three-tiered bunk beds. The selection began. No passports were required. No papers were checked. There was no roll call, no head count. One of the three officers just lifted an index finger in his snow-white glove and pointed in the direction of a pale face, while his mouth pronounced the death sentence with a single word, "Come." Like a barrage of machine gun fire came the German commands, "Come, come, 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 come." The men selected were marched outside. SS men with rubber truncheons and iron prods awaited them. They kicked, beat, and tortured the innocent victims when the tortured body no longer responded. The revolver, the pistol, was used. The random selection went on, and the brutal massacre continued until sundown. When the Nazi black angels of death departed, they left behind heaps of hundreds of tortured and twisted bodies. Then Hanukkah came to Bergen-Belsen. It was time to kindle the Hanukkah lights. A jug of oil was not to be found, no candle was in sight, and a menorah belonged to the distant past. Instead, a wooden clog, the shoe of one of the inmates, became the menorah. Strings pulled from a concentration camp uniform became wicks, and the black camp shoe polish, pure oil. Not far from the heaps of bodies, the living skeletons assembled to participate in the kindling of the Hanukkah lights. Israel Spira, the rabbi of Blutzov, lit the first light and chanted the first two blessings in his pleasant voice, and the festive melody was filled with sorrow and pain. When he was about to recite the third blessing, he stopped, turned his head, looked around as if he were searching for something. But immediately he turned his face back to the quivering small lights and in a strong, reassuring, comforting voice chanted the third blessing. "Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has kept us alive and has preserved us and enabled us to reach this season." Among the people present at the kindling of the lights was a Mr. Zema Chakowski, one of the leaders of the Warsaw Bund. He was a clever, sincere man with a passion for discussing matters of religion and faith and truth, and even here in camp at Bergen-Belsen, his passion for discussion did not abate. He never missed an opportunity to engage in such a conversation. As soon as the rabbi had finished the ceremony of kindling the lights, Zema Chakowski elbowed his way to the rabbi and said, "Spira, Spira, you're a clever and honest person. I can understand your need to light the Hanukkah candles in these wretched times. I can even understand the historical note of your second blessing. Who wrought us miracles for our fathers in days of old at this season? But the fact that you recited the third blessing is beyond me. How could you thank God and say, 'Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has kept us alive and has preserved us and enabled us to reach this season?' How could you say it, Rabbi, when hundreds of dead Jewish bodies are literally lying within the shadow of the Hanukkah lights? When thousands of living Jewish skeletons are walking around in this camp and millions more are being massacred? For this, you're thankful to God? For this, you praise the Lord? This you call keeping us alive?" "Ay, Zema Chakowski, you're 100% right," answered the rabbi. "When I reached the third blessing, I also hesitated and asked myself, what should I do with this blessing? I turned my head in order to ask the other distinguished rabbis who were standing near me if indeed I might recite the blessing. But just as I was turning my head, I noticed that behind me a throng was standing, a large crowd of still living Jews, their faces expressing faith, devotion, and concentration as they were listening to the rite of the kindling of the Hanukkah lights. So I said to myself, if God, blessed be He, has such a nation that at times like these, when during the lighting of the Hanukkah lights they see in front of them the heaps of bodies of their beloved fathers and brothers and sons, and death is looking from every corner, if despite all that, they stand in throngs and with devotion, listening to the Hanukkah blessing, who wroughtest miracles for our fathers in days of old at this season, if indeed I was blessed to see such a people with so much faith and fervor, then I am under a special obligation to recite the third blessing. Some years after liberation, the rabbi of Blutzoff, now residing in Brooklyn, New York, received regards from Mr. Zamachakowski. Zamachakowski asked the son of the Scabiner rabbi to tell Israel Spira, the rabbi of Blutzoff, that the answer he gave him that dark Hanukkah night in Bergen-Belsen had stayed with him ever since and was a constant source of inspiration during hard and troubled times. The Thai Man's Miracle, A Hanukkah Tale by Stephen Schnurr. It had just begun to snow when a bent little man limped up our front path, carrying a tattered wood cardboard box wound round and round with string. I was standing by the window waiting for Dad to get home so we could light our Hanukkah candles. "Oh, Mr. Hoffman's coming," I called to Mom. She joined me at the window inside and then hurried upstairs for her purse, telling me to let him in. When I opened the door, Mr. Hoffman bowed and asked in his thick voice, "Is your mama home, please?" His eyes were so dark they seemed almost hollow. "She'll be right down," I answered. Despite the cold, he wasn't wearing an overcoat or boots, just a rumpled gray suit and a hat. "Aren't you freezing?" I asked as I closed the door behind him.
"I have been much colder," he replied, laid his cardboard box on the kitchen table, blew on his fingers for a moment, and then began untying the knotted string.
"How old are you now, my boy?"
"7."
"7?" He studied me for a moment. "So tall. Your parents must be very proud."
Mom came into the room holding Hannah in her arms. Mr. Hoffman bowed again, then fixed his eyes on my baby sister and declared,
"Such a jewel."
Hannah gurgled at him.
"Are you working so late on Hanukkah?" Mom asked, glancing at the clock.
"Aye, a man has to eat," he replied softly, "even during the holidays. Just a minute of your time, Mrs., please."
"Isn't your family waiting for you?" I asked. I was afraid he was going to delay our celebration.
He stared at me for a moment and shook his head and said,
"I have no family."
Before I could ask why not, he removed the top of his cardboard box, revealing dozens and dozens of colorful ties. One by one, he held them up, knotting them around his fingers, draping them over his arm, laying them across the table.
"This with a blue suit would be very nice, or perhaps a paisley."
Though he promised to stay only a minute, he spent almost a half hour with Mom. When Dad finally came up the walk, I ran out to meet him and asked impatiently, "Can we light the candles now?"
"Well, let me take my coat off," Dad said and kissed the top of my head.
Mr. Hoffman was just beginning to knot up his box as we joined him.
"Would you take a look?" he asked and hurried to untie the string again.
Thank you," Dad replied, and he picked up the 5 ties Mom had bought. "But I don't think I can improve on these. Why don't you join us while we light the menorah?"
I've already taken up too much of your time," Mr. Hoffman said, and retied the box.
"It'll only take a minute," Dad insisted, "and then I'll drive you wherever you need to go. It's snowing pretty hard out."
Thank you, but I can't."
I took Dad's hand and tried to pull him toward the living room and the waiting menorah, but then my little sister began to cry.
"What's the matter, Hannah?" Mom cooed.
Mr. Hoffman looked up from the tie box, his dark eyes gleaming.
Hanala?
He whispered the name again. Hanala? He moved a little closer, repeating her name softly. It seemed to calm her.
Come, we'll light the candles together, Dad said, and laid his hand on the Thai man's forearm.
Well, maybe for a minute, Mr. Hoffman murmured. His eyes were filled with Hannah.
When we were all standing before the menorah, Dad lit the shamash, the candle that lights all the others, and handed it to our guest, asking, would you do us the honor? But Mr. Hoffman shook his head and backed away.
I can't. Let the children.
Dad looked at Mom, then passed the shamash to me. While the Thai man stood silently in the shadows, I lit the 8 remaining candles and chanted the Hebrew prayer. Blessed are you, Adonai our God, ruler of the universe, who long ago performed miracles for our ancestors at this season.
Amen, Mr. Hoffman whispered.
Happy Hanukkah, Dad announced, and handed me a large box. For the next few minutes, I forgot about our guest, and then I heard Mom ask, are you all right? I looked up to see Mr. Hoffman watching Hannah. His eyes were burning with tears.
Excuse me, I must go. It's late.
Let me drive you, Dad insisted.
No, I couldn't. Thank you, he replied, stepped away from us.
I wanted to take his hand and pull him back, but before I could, he turned and limped to the kitchen for his box.
Why is he so sad?
Mom shushed me, looking toward the kitchen.
How come he doesn't have a family? I pursued.
Mr. Hoffman appeared in the doorway, his cardboard box under his arms.
I had a family once, he answered quietly. A very big family.
What happened to them? I asked. Seth, please, Mom interrupted. Her cheeks were getting red.
A sad story, the Thai man said. This is supposed to be a happy night.
It's also a night for remembering, Dad said, offering him a chair. Please. Mr. Hoffman hesitated, then sat at the very edge of the cushion, resting his box on his knees. Mom and I settled onto the couch with Hannah between us.
Long ago, before you were born, I had a boy your age, Shmuel, Samuel, as you say here. He was my oldest 7 years, just like you, but he was not so tall as you. His younger brother, Isaac, was to be the tall one.
He paused for a moment, lost in thought.
Any girls? Mom asked. 3. Sarah, Leah, and my own little Hannah.
He reached inside his jacket and removed a torn and faded photograph of himself, sitting stiffly beside a young woman holding a newborn baby. 2 small girls dressed in white sat at his feet. 2 older boys stood behind him.
Why aren't you celebrating Hanukkah with them, I asked. Do they live far away?
The Thai man nodded his head very slowly.
Yes, very far.
Where, I asked.
They're gone. I lost them in the war.
Mom put her hand to her mouth.
How, I asked. How could someone lose his whole family and not find them again?
How?
Only God can answer that question.
We've never spoken to Seth of that time, Dad said gently, looking at me.
Forgive me, the Thai man apologized.
Dad took my hand. Before you were born, there was a terrible war. Many people were killed, especially Jewish people.
Even children, I asked, thinking about Mr. Hoffman's family.
Even children. Outside, the wind hurled clouds of snow against the window. Mr. Hoffman rose.
I must go.
I'm sorry, Dad said. We didn't mean to cause you pain.
You caused me nothing, the Thai man replied. They are never out of my thoughts.
Of course they aren't, Mom said sadly. Mr. Hoffman bowed and turned toward the door.
Won't you eat something with us first, Mom pleaded. A little soup, it's so cold out.
He looked toward the window, then at Hannah and me.
A little soup would be nice, thanks.
While Mom filled our bowls, the Thai man watched Hannah crawl across the floor. When we were all served, he bowed his head for a moment and muttered a brief prayer, then picked up his spoon and began to eat.
He ate slowly, as though he could feel every spoonful warming and strengthening him. After finishing, he leaned toward me and said,
"Before I go, let me tell you a happy story.
In our village, we believe that every Hanukkah was a time of miracles, just as it had been for the Maccabees. On the eighth night, we didn't just light the menorah, but we watched the candles burn all the way down, believing that if they all went out exactly at the same instant, those nine little columns of smoke would rise as one up to heaven, carrying our wishes straight to the ear of God." He held out his hands, palms up, and slowly raised his fingers toward the ceiling. It had to be all nine candles. Nothing less could travel so far.
"Did they ever all go out together?" I asked.
He shook his head.
"I never saw it. Usually the shamash died first, and one by one the other eight."
He leaned a little closer and whispered,
"But you never know. Watch them carefully. Perhaps tonight your dreams will come true."
"Why don't you stay and see for yourself?" Dad suggested.
"Thank you," he replied, and he rose up. "But now I must go."
"Please stay," I pleaded. "Don't you have a wish?"
"Ay, sonny, I'm afraid my wish is too heavy, even for all nine candles."
He looked at Hannah one last time.
"Take care of your little sister."
Then he leaned down and stroked her cheek. Hannah cooed at him, and for just a moment the Thai man smiled, his eyes glistening as brightly as the candles. Later, while Mom and Dad put Hannah to bed, I returned to the darkened living room. The nine candles had burned down to the menorah itself, each one nothing more than a tiny black wick surrounded by a small blue flame. I wanted to shout to Mom and Dad to come look, but I was afraid if I stirred, one of them would go out before the others, breaking the spell. In the fading light, I silently wished, "Please, please, give the Thai man back to his family." The shamash flickered, and then so did the other eight candles. I held my breath. A moment later, the room went black. Nine narrow columns of smoke rose from the silver menorah. A little way above my head, they seemed to join in a delicate braid, rising faster. Suddenly, the room grew bright. I heard voices shouting, "Papa! Papa!" Shadows danced on the ceiling. Feet scurried across the floor. Laughter filled the air. And then, all was silent and dark. Spring came, then summer, and finally the cold. But not the Thai man. Every time the doorbell rang, I ran to answer it, hoping to find him standing there with his cardboard box. But he never returned. And not since that snowy evening have I seen all nine candles burn out together. Still, every year, Hannah and I look forward to the eighth night with special excitement. Sitting before the menorah, our heads resting on our hands, we whisper our secret dreams as the tiny blue flames burn down and disappear in a flicker of light and a whirl of smoke. So, I invite you to light up your own candles, watch the light flicker. The light you are watching carries a spark from that eternal light burning in the rededicated temple. The moment when a few people spoke up for the right to practice their religion as they saw fit. Matthias's call to keep the faith still echoes, resounding through centuries of Jewish history and eventually our own history. Think of the ancient times, for who can retell the things that befall us? Who? The answer dances in the light of the candles. A candle. A simple candle is such a small thing, but one candle can light others. And see how its light increases, and as a candle gives its flame to the others, we too can be such a light. My name is Les Schaefer, and I wish you bright joyfulness. Happy Hanukkah.
You've been listening to storyteller Les Schaefer, telling stories of Hanukkah, presented by the Virginia Voice.